She pictured the virus in the databank, his failing marriage, that eerie nod he had given her. Her footing faltered. She spun on the landing, grappling for the banister. "Commander, no!" Susan was momentarily frozen, her mind blank. The echo of the gunshot seemed to drown out the chaos around her. Her mind told her to keep on going, but her legs refused. "Commander!" An instant later, she found herself stumbling back up the stairs, entirely forgetting the danger around her. She ran blindly, slipping on the slick metal. Above her, the humidity fell like rain. When she reached the ladder and began climbing, she felt herself lifted from below by a tremendous surge of steam that practically jettisoned her through the trap door. She rolled onto the crypto floor and felt the cool air wash over her. Her white blouse clung to her body, soaked through. It was dark. Susan paused, trying to get her bearings. The sound of the gunshot was on endless loop in her head. Hot steam billowed up through the trapdoor like gases from a volcano about to explode. Susan cursed herself for leaving the Beretta with Strathmore. She had left it with him, hadn't she? Or was it in Node 3? As her eyes adjusted to the dark, she glanced toward the gaping hole in the Node 3 wall. The glow from the monitors was faint, but in the distance she could see Hale lying motionless on the floor where she'd left him. There was no sign of Strathmore. Terrified of what she'd find, she turned toward the commander's office. But as she began to move, something registered as strange. She backpedaled a few steps and peered into Node 3 again. In the soft light, she could see Hale's arm. It was not at his side. He was no longer tied like a mummy. His arm was up over his head. He was sprawled backward on the floor. Had he gotten free? There was no movement. Hale was deathly still. Susan gazed up at Strathmore's workstation perched high on the wall. "Commander?" Silence. Tentatively, she moved toward Node 3. There was an object in Hale's hand. It glimmered in the light of the monitors. Susan moved closer. Closer. Suddenly, she could see what Hale was holding. It was the Beretta. Susan gasped. Following the arch of Hale's arm, her eyes moved to his face. What she saw was grotesque. Half of Greg Hale's head was soaked in blood. The dark stain had spread out across the carpet.
"Oh my God!"
Susan staggered backward. It wasn't the commander's shot she heard. It was Hale's. As if in a trance, Susan moved toward the body. Apparently, Hale had managed to free himself. The printer cables were piled on the floor beside him. "I must have left the gun on the couch," she thought. The blood flowing through the hole in his skull looked black in the bluish light. On the floor beside Hale was a piece of paper. Susan went over unsteadily and picked it up. It was a letter. "Dearest friends, I am taking my life today in penance for the following sins." In utter disbelief, Susan stared at the suicide note in her hand. She read slowly. It was surreal, so unlike Hale. A laundry list of crimes. He was admitting to everything. Figuring out that Endokota was a hoax. Hiring a mercenary to kill Ensaitankado and take the ring. Pushing Phil Chartruckian. Planning to sell Digital Fortress. Susan reached the final line. She was not prepared for what she read. The letter's final words delivered a numbing blow. "Above all, I am truly sorry about David Becker. Forgive me. I was blinded by ambition." As Susan stood trembling over Hale's body, the sound of running footsteps approached behind her. In slow motion, she turned. Strathmore appeared in the broken window, pale and out of breath. He stared down at Hale's body in apparent shock. "Oh my God," he said. "What happened?" Chapter 93. Communion. Houlihan spotted Becker immediately. The khaki blazer was impossible to miss, particularly with a small bloodstain on one side. The jacket was moving up the center aisle in a sea of black.
"You must not know I'm here," Hulahut smiled. "He's a dead man."
He fanned the tiny metal contacts on his fingertips, eager to tell his American contact the good news.
Soon, he thought. Very soon.
Like a predator moving downwind, Hulahut moved to the back of the church. Then he began his approach, straight up the center aisle. Hulahut was in no mood to track Becker through the crowds leaving the church. His quarry was trapped. A fortunate turn of events. Hulahut just needed a way to eliminate him quietly. His silencer, the best money could buy, emitted no more than a tiny spitting cough. That would be fine. As Hulahut closed on the khaki blazer, he was unaware of the quiet murmurs coming from those he was passing. The congregation could understand this man's excitement to receive the blessing of God, but nevertheless there were strict rules of protocol. Two lines, single file. Hulahut kept moving. He was closing quickly. He thumbed the revolver in his jacket pocket. The moment had arrived. David Becker had been exceptionally fortunate so far. There was no need to tempt fortune any further. The khaki blazer was only 10 people ahead facing front. Head down. Hulahut rehearsed the kill in his mind. The image was clear. Cutting him behind Becker, keeping the gun low and out of sight, firing two shots into Becker's back. Becker slumping, Hulahut catching him and helping him into a pew like a concerned friend. Then Hulahut would move quickly to the back of the church, as if going for help. In the confusion, he would disappear before anyone knew what had happened. Five people. Four. Three. Hulahut fingered the gun in his pocket, keeping it low. He would fire from hip level, upward into Becker's spine. That way, the bullet would hit either the spine or a lung before finding the heart. Even if the bullet missed the heart, Becker would die. A punctured lung was fatal. Maybe not in more medically advanced parts of the world, but in Spain, it was fatal. Two people. One. And then Hulahut was there. Like a dancer performing a well-rehearsed move, he turned to his right. He laid his hand on the shoulder of the khaki blazer, aimed the gun, and fired. Two muffled spats. Instantly, the body was rigid. Then it was falling. Hulahut caught his victim under the armpits. In a single motion, he swung the body into a pew before any bloodstains spread across his back. Nearby, people turned. Hulahut paid no heed. He would be gone in an instant. He groped the man's lifeless fingers for the ring. Nothing. He felt again. The fingers were bare. Hulahut spun the man around angrily. The horror was instantaneous. The face was not David Becker's. Rafael de la Maza, a banker from the suburbs of Seville, had died almost instantly. He was still clutching the 50,000 pesetas the strange American had paid him for a cheap black blazer. Chapter 94. Midge Milken stood fuming at the water cooler near the entrance to the conference room. What the hell is Fontaine doing? She crumpled her paper cup and threw it forcefully into the trash can. There's something happening in crypto. I can feel it. Midge knew there was only one way to prove herself right. She'd go check out crypto herself. Track down Java if need be. She spun on her heel and headed for the door. Brinkerhoff appeared out of nowhere, blocking her way. Where are you headed?
Home,
Midge lied. Brinkerhoff refused to let her pass. Midge glared. Fontaine told you not to let me out, didn't he? Brinkerhoff looked away.
Chad, I'm telling you, there's something happening in crypto, something big. I don't know why Fontaine's playing dumb, but Translator's in trouble. Something is not right down there tonight.
Midge, he soothed, walking past her toward the curtained conference room windows. Let's let the director handle it. Midge's gaze sharpened.
Do you have any idea what happens to Translator if the cooling system fails?
Brinkerhoff shrugged and approached the window. Power's probably back online by now anyway. He pulled apart the curtains and looked. Still dark? Midge asked. But Brinkerhoff did not reply. He was spellbound. The scene below in the crypto dome was unimaginable. The entire glass cupola was filled with spinning lights, flashing strobes, and swirling steam. Brinkerhoff stood transfixed, teetering lightheaded against the glass. Then, in a frenzy of panic, he raced out.
Director! Director!
Chapter 95. The Blood of Christ, the Cup of Salvation. People gathered around the slumped body in the pew. Overhead, the frankincense swung its peaceful arcs. Houlihan wheeled wildly in the center aisle and scanned the church.
He's got to be here.
He spun back toward the altar. 30 rows ahead, Holy Communion was proceeding uninterrupted. Padre Gustave Serrara, the head chalice-bearer, glanced curiously at the quiet commotion in one of the center pews. He was not concerned. Sometimes some of the older folks were overcome by the Holy Spirit and passed out. A little air usually did the trick. Meanwhile, Houlihan was searching frantically. Becker was nowhere in sight. 100 or so people were kneeling at the long altar receiving communion. Houlihan wondered if Becker was one of them. He scanned their backs. He was prepared to shoot from 50 yards away and make a dash for it.
El cuerpo de Jesús, el pan del cielo.
The young priest serving Becker communion gave him a disapproving stare. He could understand the stranger's eagerness to receive communion, but it was no excuse to cut in line. Becker bowed his head and chewed the wafer as best he could. He sensed something was happening behind him, some sort of disturbance. He thought of the man from whom he'd bought the jacket, and hoped he had listened to his warning, and not taken Becker's in exchange. He started to turn and look, but he feared the wire-rimmed glasses would be staring back. He crouched in hopes his black jacket was covering the back of his khaki pants. It was not. The chalice was coming quickly from his right. People were already swallowing their wine, crossing themselves, and standing to leave.
Slow down.
Becker was in no hurry to leave the altar. But with 2,000 people waiting for communion, and only 8 priests serving, it was considered bad form to linger over a sip of wine. The chalice was just to the right of Becker when Houlihan spotted the mismatched khaki pants.
Estás ya muerto. He hissed softly. You're already dead.
Houlihan moved up the center aisle. The time for subtlety had passed. 2 shots in the back, and he would grab the ring and run. The biggest taxi stand in Seville was half a block away on Mateus Cago. He reached for his weapon.
Adios, Señor Becker.
La sangre de Cristo, la copa de la salvación.
The thick scent of red wine filled Becker's nostrils as Padre Herrera lowered the hand-polished silver chalice. Little early for drinking, Becker thought as he leaned forward. But as the silver goblet dropped past eye level, there was a blur of movement. A figure coming fast, his shape warped in the reflection of the cup. Becker saw a flash of metal, a weapon being drawn. Instantly, unconsciously, like a runner from a starting block at the sound of a gun, Becker was vaulting forward. The priest fell back in horror as the chalice sailed through the air and red wine rained down on white marble. Priests and altar boys went scattering as Becker dove over the communion rail. A silencer coughed out a single shot. Becker landed hard, and the shot exploded in the marble floor beside him. An instant later, he was tumbling down 3 granite stairs into the vale, a narrow passageway through which the clergy entered, allowing them to rise onto the altar as if by divine grace. At the bottom of the steps, he stumbled and dove. Becker felt himself sliding out of control across the slick, polished stone. A dagger of pain shot through his gut as he landed on his side. A moment later, he was stumbling through a curtained entryway and down a set of wooden stairs. Pain.